Hey babe, it's Ezra. Welcome to Two Queers, Five Books, an outgrowth of our other gay Jewish podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions, in which we took a look at all the Jewish holidays. This time around, we're looking at the weekly Torah portion and finding out what we might say about it, how to dance with it, how to fight with it, and ultimately how to love it as our own. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoy.
Vayeshev. So much happens in this parsha. It's almost too much to narrate. Joseph gets his fancy coat. He has the dreams that make his brothers hate him. He goes to find them in the fields. They conspire to kill him, end up throwing him in a pit, and then selling him into slavery. He ends up in Egypt, rising in the house of Potiphar, only to be tossed in prison, interpret more dreams, think his interpretations might save his neck, and then find himself again forgotten. Meanwhile, there is an interlude with Joseph's brother Judah and his daughter-in-law Tamar, involving two dead sons, a lot of resentment, some birth control, a retrogressive legal structure that allows a disengaged slash probably grief-stricken Judah to leave Tamar in a legal and emotional limbo. There is some deception, some prostitution, and a pregnancy with twins. It's a lot. And all of it is hard to talk about without talking about what happens later. The fact that there will be more reversals of fortune in Joseph's future, that a famine will come, that he will find himself in a position to save his brothers. More than any parsha, it's hard to talk about what happens here without talking about what happens after. Two parshiot from now, Joseph will insist to his brothers that the whole thing needs to be interpreted in light of a larger divine vision. It was not you who sent me here, but God, he says, and it was to save life that God sent me ahead of you. Which all feels kind of like a lesson to us as interpreters of story, as readers of our own lives. It's as if we are always going to fail to recognize what is actually going on in the moment of its unfolding. So what are we to make of the little word that comes up twice in this parsha? Lehakir, to recognize. The first time it comes up, the brothers have sent Joseph's coat back to their father, Jacob. They've slaughtered a baby goat and smeared its blood all over the beautiful garment, thinking that they can disguise what has actually happened. They have sold Joseph into slavery. The coat, of course, is already emotionally charged. It's a beautiful coat, a rare coat, a singular coat, a coat that Jacob has given Joseph because, as everyone knows, he loves Joseph most of all his children. They send the coat and they say, "Do you recognize this, Hakirna? It's your son's coat, no?" And then we are told that Jacob does indeed recognize it, same word, Vayakira, and comes a little too quickly to a sort of melodramatic but tidy conclusion. "My son's tunic," he says. "A savage beast devoured him." I want to pause and unpack the symbolic drama a little bit here. My memory of this parsha was always that this savage beast idea is one that the brothers plant in their father's head. We're going to make it look like X and convince him that X happened. But when the brothers dip the coat in blood, the text never actually tells us why, which makes Jacob's hasty and sort of random conclusion even stranger. What if the brothers are not trying to hide something? What if they are trying to reveal something? Something too painful for words? What if they are actually asking their father to look at something he doesn't want to look at? What if the bloody coat isn't a lie, but a deeper kind of truth? Judah, in fact, has just asked, "What do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Let us kill him in a different way and make the blood visible. This blood that ties us to him, that ties us to you, this blood that represents our murderous anger." Because if the idea that Joseph has been murdered is a lie, it is also a kind of truth. The brothers originally wanted to murder Joseph. In a funny way, the brothers dip the coat in blood because they want to reveal something about themselves, not conceal it. And do we really think that Jacob didn't see all that when he saw the coat? Of course he did. Of course he saw in that moment how his own refusals of love had given birth to such rage and ultimately such pain within his own family. I refuse to believe that he did not see it all, that the father did not understand his sons perfectly well. "We have murdered your love," they told him. "We have murdered you. We loved you and you refused to see us. You loved Joseph and that love has murdered us. You have murdered us. Look at us all here together, Dad, drenched in blood. But that is so much, so painful for Jacob in this moment. So he externalizes it. A bloody beast did this, when the bloody beast is actually his own children, when the bloody beast is himself. It is not because he is confused that Jacob mourns for many days and refuses to be comforted. It's because he sees the truth. He grieves himself, his own looking away, his own cruelty, and he cannot be comforted because the things he's grieving have not actually died. The same word, recognize, comes up later in the Parsha, in the story of Tamar. Tamar has, trapped in a misogynistic legal nightmare limbo, decided to get her father-in-law's attention by pretending to be a sacred prostitute and getting him to sleep with her. She succeeds. He gives the woman he doesn't recognize as his daughter-in-law, the daughter-in-law who has lived in his household many years now, through the death of two sons and the long childhood of a third. He gives her his seal and his cord and his staff as a guarantee of future payment. Later he goes looking for the prostitute he thought he slept with to pay her, and she isn't there. Eventually, Tamar gets pregnant and comes to Judah with the seal, cord, and staff, and says, "Recognize these? Hakerna?" She's asking him to look at a situation that he has decided is unrelated to him, a situation in which he sees he has no agency or involvement, and says, "No, look, this is you. You are here. And also, look at me. I am here. I have been here a long time. I loved at least one of your children, and perhaps there was a time when I loved you." So what particular kind of a call does this word represent? The text could have easily given us a simpler word. Look, habetna, or look, ru'u, which is what Potiphar's wife says in this parsha. Look, ru'u, at this coat. My husband had to bring us a Hebrew to dally with us. Instead, we get the twisted, painful idea of recognition. It is, on the one hand, a call for justice. Look, see, we have been wronged. We are tricking you, have lied, have trapped you, are hurting you, but you are complicit here. You are hurting, but you must see that you must see your part in the way things have unfolded. Christina Sharp, in Ordinary Notes, writes about how whiteness is so obsessed with innocence. Rather than seek justice, so many of us just want to be innocent, to be reassured. Horrible things have happened, but we are good, aren't we? We, personally, have no part in this. Recognition, hakerna, is a word of messy complicity. It's messy because in the stories here, the brothers have done something wrong, and so has Tamar. She has deceived her father-in-law, has made him a non-consensual father of twins. No one is innocent. But in the brothers' violence and Tamar's deception, Jacob and Judah are forced to confront the ways in which years and years of passive cruelty and neglect have put the people around them in impossible situations. We have murdered your son, but so have you. You have murdered us. I have deceived you, but you have deceived yourself as well. You have refused to see me all these years. So it's a call to justice, but it's also a call to love, a call of hurt. It's a call of the kind of complicated love that hasn't been given its due. Love that hasn't been tended to, love that has been blocked, ignored, starved, love thwarted, love denied, love met with indifference. Hakerna is a phrase of brokenheartedness and betrayal. I am this week, as every week, thinking about the war in Gaza. And we may feel that we are at a point where love is impossible. But I feel that our sacred obligation is to believe that the story isn't over yet. That there is a future Parsha in which some measure of grief is given space, where some measure of justice is done and a path towards love, or at least relationship, is possible. Hakerna, hakerna, hakerna. In grief, in rage, we are talking about complicity. We are not ready, not yet, maybe, to talk about love. So how do we get there? In September of next year, we will read Ki Tetzé. In a long list of laws, we will hear about the issue of a husband who has two wives, one loved, one unloved, and who, because he loves the one wife and not the other, decides to favor a younger child over an older. It will be hard not to think about Jacob and his preference for Rachel over Leah. It will be hard not to think about Jacob's blinding love for Joseph. But here we get a legal solution. Indeed, this father must accept the firstborn, the son of the unloved wife, and allot him a double portion of all he possesses, since he is the first fruit of his vigor. The birthright is his due. Ki et habechor ben hasnu'a yakir. It's the same word, yakir. Love is hard to legislate. I believe in love, as radically framed by prophets and mystics from Meister Eckhart to Martin Luther King, and that love is a demand. That love is a form of justice, of revolution, of creation. And also there is the daily love, which is hard. It can be hard to get there when we are hurting, but we can start with legal measures. We recognize injustice, we recognize our own complicity, there are reparations, there is land back, there is an end to occupation. There is a provision of resources to rebuild what we ourselves have destroyed. These stories are long. The ask is hard. Hakerna. It may be demanding of us things we are not ready to see or say or do. But the story is not over yet. We have to find a path.